Mitt Romney taking shots to the president is not new, but of late it has been. In 2018, he thanked the president for his endorsement. That's January. In January 1, he takes a shot. Why?
Well, this is a pathetic attempt by Mitt Romney for relevancy. This is a guy who comes to Washington, and instead of trying to help this president, instead of trying to help the Republican Party, he wants to attack this president and really try to undo and be the center of attention. Look, he wants to talk about character. Let's talk about jealousy. Let's talk about how shallow this person is. I'm sick and tired of Mitt Romney wanting Donald Trump's help on one hand, groveling, trying to be the Secretary of State during the transition in 2016. Let's not forget that pathetic attempt by Mitt Romney.
That was President Donald Trump's favorite television program, Fox and Friends, this very morning talking about the bracing slap of an op-ed published in today's Washington Post by rookie Senator Mitt Romney, or Senator-elect, to announce his arrival on Capitol Hill. Hello, everyone. Happy New Year to you from all of us here at the Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined in our editor's round table by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hey, 19, y'all.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy Wednesday.
I'm here to make Nick Gillespie groan. Subscribe to The Reason Podcast today and every day at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so on. Rate and review and so forth. So we were wondering here a month or two ago, I forget when exactly, who would be the next temperamentally centrist Republican politician to win the hearts and minds of Washington's political class by pivoting to anti-Trump scoldery, and I think we might have our answer this morning.
Ding, ding,
Peter,
ding.
Ding, ding, ding. Step away, sass. Here comes Mitt. Peter, you wrote a great cover story on the Mittster back in 2012 called Consultant in Chief, which, if memory serves, you talked a lot about how he kind of very carefully management consultingly kind of tweaks what is acceptable in terms of selling his politics, which tends to be kind of minor tweaks on the ship of state. Meanwhile, doing it in such a way that, you know, no budget ever gets balanced in the future, and that it's kind of a cautious approach. Yet this thing strikes me as kind of not particularly cautious. It was stronger than anything I expected. And it included the line, "We must repair our fiscal foundation." What gives, say you, Suter Pants?
Well, Mitt Romney has never been a particularly ideological guy when it comes to policy. And that was sort of the meta argument of that piece, which is that he's not somebody who comes in and sort of has an idea that, the government should be smaller, or the government should be larger even, or that instead he's sort of like, well, let's look for it's this kind of moderate, no ideology, let's look for practical solutions sort of thing. Let's tweak what we can and try and make things sort of function better. You know, basically sort of treated government like a management consultant treats the companies that they end up working for, which makes sense given his background, where he was a management consultant and then went on to financial work with Bain. But he does have another kind of ideology, I think, that is expressing itself more in the Trump era. And that is a sort of Mormon ideology of niceness. And like Donald Trump really deeply triggers that instinct in Mitt Romney and in some other people, but particularly in a guy like Mitt Romney, who is now, you know, representing Utah, taking the mantle of the decent moderate here in Washington, the decent moderate Republican, to be clear. And like as somebody like Donald Trump, just in terms of personality, in terms of the way he goes about his business, the way he expresses himself both privately and publicly, is just temperamentally almost exactly the opposite of Mitt Romney, who, you know, when I was researching that piece, I talked to a couple of people who had worked with him, who knew him. And what everybody said was that he was incredibly decent, sometimes very slightly distant and aloof, which, again, kind of understandable, given that the guy's worth $250 million and has spent most of his life kind of in elite society. But really incredibly decent and nice, and that that was actually the thing that he was good at, was being like a sort of a smart, clever, decent, nice person. And so, you know, one of the kind of sub-arguments of that piece, I'm not sure I made it explicitly, but sort of one of the things that I came away thinking was that Mitt Romney, you know, sort of isn't great when it comes to kind of sort of ideological policy decision making, but he is somebody who has done really well in the business world and has been a force for good overall, a force for decency and transparency within his business life, and I think he is trying to bring some of that sort of personality driven ideology, if that makes any sense. To his, it comes close to making sense. Don't give me that look, Catherine. Catherine is giving me a Peter. You've started on the wrong foot. I am striking that phrase from your piece.
I feel like you're just
editor's
you're just,
look here.
That's your own conscience talking. I think, yeah. As Donald Trump would say,
I think you're my conscience.
A question will be: is he a flake? That's what Trump tweeted about Romney. That is
capital
the question:
F.
Is he a flake? Capital F flake.
He still got it. He hasn't lost anything off that fastball, the tweeter fastball. But Catherine, to follow up on that, is there any reason that you can see that Romney doesn't end up a flake or a Bob Corker, to put a non-Mormon in there, which is the people in the Republican Party who have loudly scolded the tone of and some of the behavior and policies of Donald Trump have ended up loathed in their own states and pretty much roadkill?
It's hard to imagine Mitt Romney winding up loathed in his own state. I mean, his underlying conditions are a little bit different there, but anything's possible. I don't know. I think, you know, the fact that these two guys are both Mormons is not a coincidence. As Peter says, to me, the Mormon niceness thing is just a sort of hyper-concentrated form of the American niceness thing, which, depending on your perspective, people either celebrate or kind of despair over, right? This sort of privileging of just being nice to each other, which Canadians take to the nth degree. You know, Americans are still sort of nice and friendly and known as friendly people around the world.
But Canadians go too far.
Take it too far. I mean, let's be real. Sometimes you got to have some real talk, but I think, you know, I am delighted that Mitt Romney has positioned himself to be this guy. I think he is better able to be this guy, this sort of moderate voice of reason Republican guy than Flake was. Flake was in a much weaker position.
Flake was better on policy.
Flake was better on policy.
I mean,
for
like,
sure.
We should make
but
this
partially
distinction.
For that reason, he was in a weaker position. No,
but, you know, we all have a lot to be pissed at Mitt Romney for. If Mitt Romney had run a halfway decent campaign back in, 2012, we wouldn't be talking about any
of this. And let us never forget his immigration.
He missed a layup.
His immigration positions are truly, I mean, he has explicitly said he's more hawkish than Trump on immigration. He has said that. He said that during his campaign. He's unlikely to back away from that in the current climate. And I think it would be a shame if the way that Romney and Trump manage to make peace is if they just shut down all of immigration.
Although it's possible to imagine that Romney disagreeing with something like the family separation policy. Again, basically on niceness grounds, but also on the understanding that it is politically not viable.
Yeah, I think this gets to an interesting question, because people want a return to some level of civility, because the way that Trump is acting is really reprehensible, and it does not help. I don't think it helps anything other than his own agenda, maybe some cable news ratings, but ultimately the reason we're screwed isn't because Trump is an asshole and calls people that he sleeps with horse face on Twitter or any of that kind of stuff. It's that his policies are screwed up, and that the Congress's policies are screwed up, and that Hillary Clinton's policies, Barack Obama's policies, Bush's policies, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's policies are screwed up, and that we're not talking about policy. Because, you know, amazingly, Romney, and this was at the time when Barack Obama was really anti-immigration, where he was really getting rid of people and bouncing them out, you know, deporting them, turning them away and all kinds of stuff like that. Romney was to the right of him. He somehow did that. He was totally ineffectual in any kind of argument against the Affordable Care Act. He is not good on things like paid family leave. And for all of his talk about being a businessman, he never came up with a budget, or he couldn't even, Matt, I believe you wrote about this, where when he was asked, what could you cut? He could never name a specific program.
Oh, he very specifically said that the problem of his run against Ted Kennedy, Peter, correct me where I'm wrong here, but his failed campaign in the 90s was that he made the mistake of speaking about something that might be cut one day. And he learned from, this was in an interview he gave with a Weekly Standard at some point. And so, like, he was conscious of that and said, I won't cut. Let's build on that, actually, because part of the quote unquote deep dissent that Romney lays out as the kind of precipitating factor for his op-ed, deep dissent that Donald Trump took the nation in December, had to do with the resignations of Jim Mattis and John Kelly, plus the, quote, abandonment of allies who fight beside us, which is fancy talk for we're pulling 2,000 troops out of Syria and I don't like it, and maybe 7,000 out of Afghanistan. And he further goes on to say, kind of bemoan that too many other countries are looking for China and Russia for leadership. They're autocratic. The world needs American leadership, and it's in Americans' interest to provide it. Catherine, sounds like a bunch of neocon claptrap.
Why you got to turn to me for this one?
Why do you think I got to turn for you for this? No, but like,
yeah, no.
Do you see this as part of the, I mean, there's a piece of the New York Review of Books that we were swapping around on Slack, or Shika was earlier. Is resistance GOP morphing into kind of a neoconservative backbench?
So, I mean, it's a good move rhetorically by Romney in this piece to kind of, not directly, but to subtly lump together some of Trump's tendencies with the rise of authoritarianism around the world, right? I mean, he doesn't say it outright, but he's sort of implying, listen, it's in America's interest to not be like all these authoritarian douchebags everywhere else. Instead, we need to, and then he says, you know, a free press, rule of law, strong churches, responsible corporations and unions, right? So he's sort of doing the thing that many commentators have done, which is lump the rise of Trump in with the rise of you know, autocracies and authoritarian regimes around the world. So, you know, you can see why he's doing that in this op-ed, in which his goal is to say character matters, we can do better, etc. You know, I think he does explicitly at the top of the piece, he says there are some policies that he's had that I think have been good. And then he says, but policies are only part of the presidency. So, you know, I think neoconservatism has always operated on the level of, you know, the strong executive can lead America into a more aggressive and interventionist role in the world. Obviously, I don't think that that's the right use of any president's time and talents. I doubly don't think it's a good idea to encourage Donald Trump to do that. You know, at the same time, I think it's, for many people, that is the strongest argument for why we should care about the president's character, because the president does have so much influence over the way we interact as a nation with other nations. So I think he's just trying to make the strongest case for why we care about character.
Nick, let's talk about the character a little bit. There's the line that I saw libertarian Twitter get antsy about was, to a great degree, a presidency shapes the public character of the nation. Do you agree with that statement, Nick Lesby?
No, I don't. I think it has an influence, and it has implications. But no, the whole idea that somehow we are modeled, the body politic somehow takes on the look and feel and attitudes of whoever happens to be leading us from the White House is positively medieval.
Do you think the presidency reflects the character of the nation?
Yeah, I think it's all it's kind of a jumble and a mix. And I do think one of the cheats in Romney's formulation here is to lump in I think autocrats, you know, actual autocrats like the regime that runs Saudi Arabia, say, or Iran, or a variety of countries who we could be fighting with or fighting against at any given point, because you can throw in, you know, Pakistan as well, all of this kind of stuff. With other recent developments that are contemporaneous with Trump, that are I think speaking to something fundamentally different, and by that I mean the rise of Macron in France and Brexit. These are not like moral failings on the part of a country any more than it was a moral failing of America that we ended up electing Trump. These are lagging indicators that a system of representative government is no longer working in the way that people expected it to be. And really weird, unpredictable things happen when that happens. And that's very different than, you know, nobody in Brexit, and Macron is not doing this, and even Trump is not doing this in any way other than at the most atmospheric, high atmospheric rhetorical way of saying, like, we've got to shut down the press. We've got to shut down this. We've got to shut down that. They're not taking people's passports, et cetera, or anything like that. And right there, you see the limit of Mitt Romney's vision, but also I think the veracity of his tone stuff. Like, this is just a way to kind of say nothing and seem as if you're being presidential. I want to know what Mitt Romney's going to do about the goddamn budget and about the debt, more than I want to know whether or not he's going to be a nice guy.
Well, he's in the Senate as a Republican, so he's probably going to vote for stuff that Mitch McConnell tells him to vote for.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I do think, like, he's being pretty clear here. Like, he doesn't think that's the priority. He sat down, he did himself like a racy chart or something probably, and he was like, here's what I can do while I'm in D.C.
Yeah, and so let me push back on what Nick says just a little. I think you're right that we place too much emphasis on kind of the character of the president as being a moral leader in certain ways. On the other hand, we should expect more from the president, I think, than we're getting from mm-hmm. Trump. And Romney is saying these things, is saying policy kind of doesn't matter right now, character does, because Trump's in office. And the discourse in our politics right now looks the way it does in large part because Trump is the central figure in it, and so plays a huge role and dominates political discourse and changes its tone and character, and has made it difficult to talk about policy, I think, made it difficult for people to have those conversations, in part because Trump is so completely out of it himself and is so completely does not care. Like,
come on. Like, you're telling me Congress, you know, what did they do about DACA? You know, he told them, you've got 6 months, come up with some fucking bill and put it across my desk. And he basically said that he would sign anything.
They did not
put anything on his desk.
That's because they couldn't figure out what he was going to sign. And they said, we're not going to send him something.
Like, force it. I mean, like, you're acting like Congress is more powerful than the president. You know, they did not actually create legislation. They're the ones who have to write the budgets and pass the bills. Let the president veto stuff. I'm just saying, like, again and again, we keep coming back to, and this is, I think it's a serious problem that can't be addressed by, you know, kind of the discussions that we're having now. But, you know, it's, oh, well, we don't know if the president will sign it, so let's just not offer him anything. Let's not actually muscle stuff through the House of Representatives or the Senate. That's got to end.
So Nancy Pelosi's argument,
like Mitt Romney, I mean, it's a good thing for Mitt Romney to be pushing that kind of leadership rather than these anodyne, you know, gems about civility and agreeing and disagreeing.
So we're in favor of Nancy Pelosi now in charge of the House, standing up to Trump and saying, here, sign this. You should do this and that.
Having her actually pass legislation and debate legislation. That
no,
would
I
be
agree.
Nice.
I mean, yeah. And she's basically making this argument that the Congress is a co-equal branch and needs to stand up to the president and has not under while Republicans have been in charge of both branches.
We want Congress to rise to the mantle of the office, in the words of Mitt Romney.
Wait, how do you feel about rising to mantles?
I'm upset about it. This is a terrible mixed metaphor, and I have.
Is it a mixed metaphor or just a clumsy?
I think it's mixed.
Like,
I mean,
is he talking about
can't...
a mantle? Is it the fireplace?
No,
or
in
like,
this case,
you know, something you put on your
the
shoulder.
Mantle
it's
is
the alcoholic
cloak.
Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it's yeah. The mantle is the cloak worn by the king, right?
Right.
And you don't rise to a mantle. You don it, you are worthy yeah. of it, maybe.
What
but,
if you like? Yeah, what if it's like one of those maybe... situations where you stand up from your throne and your servant, like, has the mantle kind
this,
of ready and
are
waiting
you telling
for
us
you?
This is how you get dressed in the morning, Peter? Is there something you need to?
I put on my mantle every morning. I just don't wear it
one
to the
leg
office.
At a time, just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Let's actually build on what Peter was talking about in terms of Nancy Pelosi handing things to the desk of the president. She has the opportunity to do that. And there has been reporting that she's planning on it, which is to say, have the House, when it's sworn in this week, right? It's sworn in this week, hand a bill over that is identical to the bill that the Senate passed 100-0 unanimously as a short-term resolution funding the government until February 8th or some damn thing, and basically force that onto Mitch McConnell's desk and see whether the Republicans will again pass something now that like before. Peter, would you imagine that would what do you think Mitch McConnell will do in that situation?
I mean, I think that the negotiation here is like Mitch McConnell's just not a part of it. What Mitch McConnell and his spokespeople keep saying is that they're not going to pass something unless there's certain Trump will sign it. And so they are pass-throughs for a negotiation between the House and the White House. And so this is between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. And that's why I think that the shutdown is going to continue is quite likely to continue for a long time. It's not certain, but quite likely. And why I think that policy arguments are going to get weird in 2019. Because
that's
Donald
our quote
Trump,
from this podcast, by the yeah. way, policy arguments are going to get weird
yep.
in 2019.
That's my prediction for the new year. Because it's Nancy Pelosi versus Donald Trump. Donald Trump has no idea what he wants. He just wants to come out a winner himself. And Nancy Pelosi has, mostly for worse, an actual policy agenda.
Nick, what do you take of, you've written about this a bit, of what Trump is kind of doing in terms of his discussions of border wall, border security, border croquet fence, I don't know what, in this shutdown, considering that he's in a much weaker position than he was, you know, a year ago on the same issue. Is this sort of like a last gasp expression of petulance and impotence before he turns and says, the swamp forbade me from doing it? Where do you see this in terms of the immigration debate that Trump has been having and that the country has been having?
I think one of the things that Trump is both in a terrible position in terms of, like, he really is kind of his hands are tied here. He has said that he wants at least $5.7 billion. He's kind of knocked that down a little bit. The Democrats say they don't want to do anything specifically for the wall, but they'll cough up, you know, a billion or a couple billion for border security. I think if all he needs, because this is also like you're assuming that he's like the rest of us and like his arguments to himself have to make sense. All he has to do is get anything, and then he can assert that he won and that, you know, he did the best deal that he could, and we're going to get the money, and we're going to build the wall or something like that. The other thing he's lucky about is, you know, illegal immigration to the country is declining. There's fewer immigrants, illegal immigrants, than there were 10 years ago. There's no reason to believe that's going to be changing anytime soon. So regardless, he'll be able to keep saying about how he alone has prevented, immigrants who stopped coming here a decade ago. So, you know, the mind is an incredibly flexible tool. And I think Trump knows how to lie to himself and to his base, which is really all that he cares about at this point.
I would recommend to all listeners out there, if you're going to read one Washington Post op-ed for the last 5 days, that it not be Mitt Romney's, but be Dave Barry's.
Oh, so good.
Dave Barry's.
Can we pause and just have like a moment to appreciate that Dave Barry makes that thing funny every year?
Not just funny, but like
cruel and on point and like 100% accurate rendition of the year as I remember it every single year of my entire life.
So I, in fact, should just quote a little chunk of it to get the flavor. He's going through each month of the year. February, with yet another government shutdown looming, Congress, whose irresponsible spending practices have put the nation on the road to fiscal disaster, faces a choice. It can either, one, continue to spend huge amounts of money that we don't have, or two, not. After much late night drama, Congress agrees on a compromise deal under which it'll continue to spend huge amounts of money that we don't have. Peter, you were talking about Nancy Pelosi probably coming up with bad ideas and putting them on Donald Trump's desk. Is there any evidence that there's some kind of boomerang effect where Democrats are like, well, we should be the party of fiscal discipline now because the Republicans aren't?
Not really. Not really. I mean,
that was such a nice thought.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez this morning is on Twitter opposing PAYGO. PAYGO, which basically is the, like, when you pass stuff that costs money, you have to come up with either a spending cut or a tax hike to offset it, right? You have to basically pay for it in budgetary terms. And she is just railing against it as being very bad because it stops the progressive healthcare agenda, among other things. I think that is basically where a lot of the Democratic Party is at and where the parts that aren't there yet are going to move to. I do think that we will see some differentiation in the 2020 crowd between folks who are more explicitly like, we should just ignore the budget, the debt, the deficit entirely, and we'll make that argument out loud and won't sort of walk around it. And then folks like Elizabeth Warren, among others, who are going to try to sort of carve out an argument for, they're going to talk about fiscal responsibility. They're not going to propose a bunch of policies that are fiscally responsible, but they're going to try and do things. They're going to focus on regulation, which doesn't have a direct on budget impact.
You referenced Elizabeth Warren. We might as well pivot to a conversation about her throwing her hat in the, you know, committee ring. What do you call these things? Exploratory committee ring, along with Julian Castro. She has announced that she's forming an exploratory committee to run for president here. Catherine, I was in the green room of MSNBC talking to an actual, not just Democratic strategist, but someone who works pretty closely in New York party politics. His insight was that the identity politics problem, that stupid, my family has Native American blood, I've just proved we're 100, you know, one whatevereth Native American, will be the thing, along with distrust over the way Bernie Sanders has approached the party, somehow she's associated with that, will be the sinkholes here. Do you think her candidacy is going to sort of die in an identity politics fire, given the what seems like the increase of emphasis placed upon that, or is she actually could stand to benefit from it because, unlike, you know, Joe Biden, she's not an old white male?
I don't like to see anybody die in an identity politics fire, but if someone's going to, I'm all right with it being Elizabeth Warren, because, you know, you play with fire, you're going to get burned, friends.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's
She tried to walk both sides of the identity politics thing by saying, mm-hmm, I'm Native American, but also I never benefited from it. And I, you know, who even knows if it's true? Oh, no, it definitely is true. Here are reports that definitely show it's not true. Like the attempting to walk that line has proven foolhardy. And I don't know. I actually think in some ways it's less association with Bernie and more that she feels a little bit like the worst of Hillary Clinton and Bernie together, which, ugh, I certainly hope the Democratic Party has realized is not the future of the Democratic Party. I mean, this sort of, you know, to speak bluntly, like, angry old white lady is not a lot better and, in fact, probably electorally worse than angry old white man. And
aren't you just being a self-hating lady?
I'm not angry or old, Matt.
No, wow. but are you caving no, into think, the presumed sexism of the American electorate?
I actually think it's a subsidy. Like, I don't actually think the American electorate is anti-lady, but like angry lady is yet another layer that people are struggling with right now.
I think though that you know, there's no question that Hillary Clinton is, you know, that it rises to that label, I think, or you know, of like angry old lady.
She rises to the mantle.
Yeah, she fills that mantle, you know, with a couple of pockets to spare, as long as we're mangling. Yeah.
Ladies
metaphors.
Love it when stuff has pockets.
But she has demonstrated that she is unelectable, which won't prevent her from possibly running again. Elizabeth Warren, though, I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren, despite the missteps with her her own Native American heritage and all of that, has reached out more to minorities and people of color in a way that Bernie Sanders did not. And Bernie Sanders still gets kind of attacked for that to a certain degree. And while she's angry at times, she's also kind of a school marm. And she also is constantly working the rhetoric of helping the middle class American family. And she talks a lot about stuff like free college and about healthcare that doesn't, you know, when you get a big bill that doesn't wipe you out, about making mortgage contracts understandable to a common person, blah, blah, blah. I think she her overall rhetoric is actually more interesting than any of her policies. I mean, I think she would be a total disaster, but she also signals the shift in, I think, people of, I don't think, she's obviously not a socialist, neither is Bernie, Ocasio-Cortez is, but where they're talking about socialism, they're talking about a bigger welfare state, not in order to give people more freedom. The way that they conceive of it, and I think it's a challenge for us to meet them on the rhetorical terms and explain why they're full of shit, but they're not saying it will be fair and the government will do it well, et cetera. It's that if you cannot fully participate in society, if you do not have a decent education, if you do not have enough money to pay your bills, et cetera. And it's a freedom and kind of individualism argument, which goes back, there's a strain of it in the 1950s, but generally it's not what Republicans, conservatives, and libertarians have been arguing against. And it's also not what the left traditionally had put forward. But that's the socialism debate.
Warren's argument is also, it's also more kind of directly populist and angry than I think we've seen. It is willing to place blame rather than to say, well, you know, both sides are wrong and we all need to come together.
And it's not a vague systematic.
Right.
It's
not like
system critique.
Yeah, it's the banks. Right? Yeah. It's banks.
I mean, here's how she,
you know, it's the banks, it's the regulators,
saying,
it's the people.
These aren't cracks American families are falling into. They are traps. America's middle class is under attack. How did we get here? Billionaires and big corporations decided they wanted more of the pie and they enlisted politicians to cut them a bigger slice. I mean, she is making in many ways a kind of cronyism argument, one that if it resulted in different policies, like you can imagine libertarians saying some of those words in roughly that order and then coming up with very different conclusions. But this is why I think that that Elizabeth Warren is not going to be a bad campaigner in the way that Hillary Clinton was. I think she's much more electable in a general. But I do also think that, you know, Matt's green room pal is kind of right about where the progressive base is at. When I talk to lefties these days, when I hear from them, they're very upset with Elizabeth Warren and the way that she has handled her Native American heritage and that issue.
Peter, you've written about where Elizabeth Warren's ideas would take us on regulation and spending. Can you give us the Reader's Digest version?
She is in favor, basically, of the German social democratic model. She wants to give workers and the federal government, a kind of combination of workers' interests and the federal government, a huge amount more power over corporate governance. And that's going to be her big issue. And what she basically gets to do here is take a huge amount of control and power without, in particular over how very large corporations work, without any direct on-budget cost. And that allows her to continue making, at least in passing, a fiscal responsibility argument against, for example, things like the tax bill that Republicans passed last year and the way that that Republicans have handled themselves with regard to debt and deficits.
Nick, if she was elected, she would be 71 years old on election day. Joe Biden and Michael Bloomberg would be 78. Bernie Sanders would be 79. Are you in favor of a Logan's Run constitutional amendment?
Yeah, you know, I think we're only arguing over what year, you know, the line gets drawn at.
Could we possibly draw the line at the same place as the age of eligibility, thereby eliminating the office of the presidency?
Hey,
that would be, you know, that's the type of backroom deal that you got to get Mitt Romney to kind of pass with that shiny smile and smooth rhetoric.
Just whatever age Justin Amash is.
It is. There is.
That's the only legal age.
One of the questions, and I think it obviously is too soon to tell on what happens over the next couple of years, but there is a generational shift happening, and it may not become fully clear in 2020. But you know, this is similar to, and Matt, I suspect that you, among the other people on the podcast, would remember this as much in the 90s, and it took a couple presidential elections. But when Bill Clinton won in 92, and then when he kicked Bob Dole's ass in 96, like resoundingly, you know, that was the greatest generation kind of left the stage of power. We're in the last vestiges of the baby boom generation, and all of these people, you know, are roughly like that. And it's kind of over for them. And like one or more of them might end up like eking out a win and sticking around Trump for a second term, or got, you know, somebody like Biden or even Hillary or Elizabeth Warren. But the ways that younger people talk about stuff, and this, it's not, I don't think it's merely stylistic, and I don't think it's ideological, but I think for libertarians, especially in dealing with socialism, nobody is talking about command and control stuff. For the most part, they're talking about arguments about fairness and about individuals being able to fully participate in everyday life, and that means the government needs to be doing more. In the socialist understanding, I think in the libertarian understanding, we actually have similar aims, but rather would say that the government is already doing too many bad things and keeping people from being able to do stuff. But if I worry if we don't shift our rhetoric to actually engage the arguments that are being advanced and the anxieties that are being advanced by people, we'll kind of be like shouting past people in a way that does not help get us to a point where we actually have a government that we can afford and that will protect long-term sustainable economic growth, rather than just going off the cliff with all sorts of debt and deficits and diminished economic growth.
Catherine, there's a widespread worry, fear that expressed by Mark Sanford, among other people, your outgoing friend, former Congress member, you have the kind of Trumpian nationalism, populist nationalism on the right, not just in this country, but all over the world, and kind of a respondent left populism that you could associate partly with Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez on the left, and that too will lead us to both division and disaster going forward. As you see the Warren's announcement and the reaction to it, and even the fights between the Bernie bros and the Beto bros out there. Do you see this sort of becoming a prophecy? Is the Democratic Party heading kind of in that direction firmly, or do you think it's more still an open question?
I think the Democratic Party, particularly insurgent elements in the Democratic Party, looked at Trump's nomination and the general kind of lack of control of the Republican elites that allowed that to happen. And, you know, some of them thought, oh, dear God, what a disaster. But a lot of them also thought like, well, we could do that. And I think that's one reason that we're seeing, you know, to my mind, an interesting, more kind of a broader assortment of views coming up in these initial candidates, you know, in the people initially being named as potential candidates, you know, the sort of rise of the Democratic Socialist wing, the rise of, I think, a more aggressive, progressive wing in the Democratic Party. It is all, you know, the end of control by the elites. This Mitt Romney op-ed is the counterpoint to this, right? Romney is a patrician, old school, rich white dude elite guy, and he's the one who's saying let's do civility, and it's, you know, I think it's actually a legitimate point to say the breakdown of these gatekeepers, the sort of end of the elite, is you know, it does have good effects. It does have the effect of letting people whose voices weren't heard get out there. It's just in the case of the Republican Party, I think the sort of weird quasi non-elite who emerged as a hybrid out of that process, Donald Trump, was not good. I think the Democrats could easily see the same thing, a weird quasi non-elite hybrid wild card who will be populist and bad.
Well, who do you think if on the right, though? I mean, you know, there is the, you know, Progressive Democratic Caucus or whatever, the Socialist Democrats of America, who are clearly insurgent. They are the, you know, they present themselves as the voice of young people, of diverse people. And Ocasio-Cortez is clearly like the embodiment right now, although other people are going to be moving into that space as well. Is there anything on the right that is interesting? I mean, we have our pals, you know, the guys that we've been championing, particularly Justin Amash and then Thomas Massie and Rand Paul and a couple of others. But, you know, Amash, I think, is the kind of standard bearer of that. But, you know, the Republican side does not seem to have a libertarian wing that is worth a shit or is even putting up much of a fight. And then beyond that, there really doesn't seem to be any kind of coherent new philosophy. They really are just kind of chugging along, and they take whatever Trump wants, and then they pretend that that's what they've always believed. But is there an insurgency that is like a, not even younger per se, but is a newer, different set of ideas that have something to do with, you know, with the world we live in?
I mean, I think, you know, this is something that we've talked about on this podcast before, but I think Thomas Massie kind of called this one, like, there was a thing that looked to us like a libertarian insurgency. It was the Tea Party. I drank the Flavor-Aid for sure on that one. And it's, and I think, you know,
wouldn't you drink the tea?
You know, that's a good, you know, maybe, but now, like, when the kids
Palmer.
Say, like,
can you get an Arnold
when the
Palmer
kids say, like,
the
you
tea
sip
party?
Tea or you drink tea, like, it means something else now. It means, like, oh, you told them what for, I think. But I guess what I mean to say is that it's possible that we are, I think we should be cautious about misreading the interesting, coherent, kind of vibrant, you know, insurgent Democratic Socialist and Progressive wings of the Democratic Party, because they too might just be the craziest motherfuckers in the room. Just as Massie said, when I thought, you know, when people were voting for me, I thought they were voting for my principles. They were actually voting for the craziest motherfucker in the room, and Donald Trump is the best in class.
I think he said son of a bitch.
But they've got like 80 members of a Progressive
he
caucus.
Meant motherfucker. Yeah, so it's bigger. It's 80, definitely bigger. It's a different, you know, thing. But I guess I think the Tea Party was that. And that was the cycle that we had of a libertarian-looking wing in the party. And now we're in a disillusionment cycle on libertarianism.
So I will answer that a little bit differently, which is that I think that there is no new interesting policy movement on the conventional political right, and especially within the Republican Party. But there is one that kind of exists out there outside of what we are seeing from the DSA folks and from the you know, sort of the Progressive Caucus types in Congress, and that's the young tech world. Their politics, if you look at surveys of tech leaders and of tech workers out in Silicon Valley, they're not libertarian in a traditional sense, but they look a lot more libertarian than anything else right now. And so, again, I want to be clear, they're not they are not down the line Cato, Reason, Milton Friedman libertarian in any sense, but they really are very skeptical of regulation, some of the social media hearings in Congress notwithstanding. And you look and they basically are like, well, we think high taxes are okay and we're fine with large transfer payments as long as they are simple. But what we want is for the government to get out of the way of business, of entrepreneurs, business elites, and of the private sector
people?
So these folks
are not
a movement that is outspoken. And that's the thing, is that they're not trying to change.
Name a name. I mean, because you're not talking Peter Thiel, but are you talking a, you know, who's a representative of this?
Again, I don't think that this is a movement in terms of people trying to change politics, but when you look at the surveys of tech workers and of tech sort of elites, people who are at the top of the food chain in the tech world, you see a somewhat like a notably different political outlook than you see kind of anywhere else in the country. And I think that given the overall kind of salience influence of the tech world, both on our in terms of our politics and our economy, that is a perspective that we are going to see a lot more of over the next 10 to 20 years.
I just want to point out in partial answer to a next question, one, that the Freedom Caucus, you know, at its height had some muscle and 35 members, but its leadership has gone, specifically Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, into full like Trump defense mode, and I think has lost a lot of interest in terms of its potency since then, and the dwindle our group, the Reason Caucus on Capitol Hill is teeny tiny. Just Nimash said tweeted recently, "Happy New Year, a Liberty Revolution is coming." So we have that to look forward to. Which is a note of optimism. And beyond that, I mean, the Republican Party right now, if you start looking who is being discussed as a possible either a primarier to Donald Trump or someone to, in case, you know, Trump decides to pull an LBJ and just one term it and peace out.
That could mean so many things,
oh,
Matt,
my
when you say
God.
He's about to pull at LBJ.
Oh,
it's like,
God.
He's
going
to take a dump in front of somebody else during a meeting. Yeah. Like, that's one thing.
While holding his dog
mean.
Up by the ears.
Yeah.
I
what
think,
just
he's
happened?
A lot
Don't
of
read
things.
Robert Carroll, man. You learn stuff you can't unlearn.
Yeah.
He's super can't. But no, Mitt Romney's op-ed was greeted by a lot of people like, okay, you know, he's running as a possible type of thing. But, you know, Donald Trump could resign, be impeached, whatever. So who are these people right now who are being discussed in those terms or who are trying to nominate themselves for discussion? It's Romney. It's John Kasich. The people who are attempting to generate enthusiasm for Larry freaking Hogan, the governor of Maryland that no one's heard of.
Hogan.
Whose basic thing is civility
Flake.
And being a Flake has Flake. People mention him, but he's kind of taken himself out of that. If Flake was more in that, which I think he'd be crazy to do it just because he'd get beaten up around the face and neck. But
John Kasich.
I mentioned John Kasich. I look in that crowd, and with the exception of Flake, who again has said, I'm basically not going to do this, I don't see a lot of libertarian-friendly policies coming in.
But there's just not a lot of libertarian-friendly policies anywhere right now. Right? I mean, like,
so why is that?
That's not quite true. There are some, there's criminal justice reform. We've certainly seen a lot of positive, basically positive action on marijuana legalization, on some of those things. But when it comes to the kind of core economic and budgetary issues, size of government issues, regulation. Maybe you can say, you know, look, some of the regulation
is going
stuff,
pretty well.
But when it comes to sort of core fiscal issues, we just have not seen a huge amount of libertarian policy, and people have basically given up on size of government
What
an issue.
Do you think of why? Why do you think that is? Because this, you know, this is not like a small thing, and it's like, oh, you know, we got to wait until, you know, we're stuck on this desert island or this desert planet, and we just have to wait for the next time a rocket ship comes close enough and we can hail it down and maybe hitch a ride. Is it, you know, nothing has changed in terms of the overall kind of, you know, the size, scope, and spending of government. I mean, and even to the extent there have been some good deregulatory changes, they've all been made of like, well, we just want less regulation. And nobody seems to be making a larger argument. Have we, I guess I'm asking the group, have we forgotten to rehearse the arguments for why having a government that does less and spends less is actually a good thing for a wide variety of people? Or are we merely, you know, kind of like not even getting to why this happens? It's just like, well, we're in favor of this, but now we're not in favor of it anymore, because we did jump a creek at some point, I think at the end of Bush and the beginning of Obama, where everybody was like, fuck it. We don't care about any kind of fiscal restraint. And in the end, like, we now have government spending as a percentage of GDP that has ratcheted up over 20%, which is extremely rare during peacetime. And it's just going to keep going up. And like, we need to claw back, you know, a different set of sensibility that the government can't just keep throwing money at stuff because everybody's getting something. So we might as well get ours. I think we need to really kind of revise our arguments and make them, make them great again.
I think the problem is not like libertarians haven't explained what libertarians think enough. I think a more optimistic take on it is to say that, like in academic disciplines, how you've got like once upon a time, everything was philosophy, like all of studying and thinking about the world was philosophy. And as things became as people actually learned things about various subdisciplines, they became their own thing. Like Aristotle was doing biology until biology became its own thing. And then like, mathematics broke up. Like, I kind of think maybe an optimistic take on this is like, well, libertarianism isn't winning as a category. More people don't identify as libertarians. People aren't doing libertarianism. But each time one of our things goes mainstream, it just breaks off and becomes its own thing. It just becomes criminal justice reform and everybody's for it now. Or it becomes drug legalization and everybody's for it now. It becomes gay marriage and everybody's for
capture,
it now.
To
it becomes
capture
the rights
the moment,
revolutions. And so I guess I think you could tell a story that's like, don't try to spend more time tilling the specific little libertarian field and putting up the fences. Like, just push stuff out into other people's disciplines.
We're losing the systemic argument while winning individual arguments.
I agree with
a lot of that, but I think it's also true that what happens is that in the current context, then, like, say, over regulation, when people say, Trump has loosened up a bunch of EPA regulations and FDA regulations, all of which seem to be going pretty well. The argument that gets pushed for them is that, like, well, these places just regulate too much and it's better to have less regulation. The people who push back and say, look, it's special interest politics and it's just you're paying off big pharmaceutical companies or polluters and things like that. And, it is actually worth kind of making that larger argument as these different beads on the chain or whatever are being strung together to kind of say, hey, you know what, like the good stuff that is happening here all fits into this larger narrative. And I don't expect it to be, like we're going to wake up and everybody's going to be libertarian or anything like that. But there is a very strong, I'm thinking about the way Hayek talked at the end of Why I'm Not a Conservative, where, the future is always between socialists and libertarians or liberals, because we're the only ones who have a vision of the future, really, and are pulling things or pushing things in direction, whereas conservatives tend to kind of drag behind and go in one direction or the other. And I think we really need to revive the large arguments, which are not the dogmatic, narrow dogmatic arguments from libertarians often make, but it is this question of, like, how do you live in a world that is more free, more fair, more fun, and richer? And keep folding those back into what we're doing, because otherwise it's just local politics and it's special interest politics. And I don't think that's enough of a vision to get more people moving in the direction that they should be.
I would just to narrowly answer your question, Nick, the story is that power corrupted. There was a broad-based, pretty interesting macro. We need to get federal government under control from 2009 and 2013 when that view was in opposition. But that opposition grew from the grassroots upwards and produced some new and interesting characters and produced sequestration and some other things that were, I think, definitely on the positive track. But those people got power and they became corrupted and then lost interest in that fight. That's what happens. It's a cycle. It sucks. And in doing so, they have sown the seeds of their own not going to be taken seriously next time mism. And that's that's a big problem for all of us going forward. But to Catherine's point, Peter's point, and the point that we argued in a book from 7-8 years ago, that a lot of this stuff happens as single
bingo.
Issues in various places. Thank you for the bingo. I'm going to pivot here at the end. We usually do our what you have been reading, watching, smoking thing here at the end of the podcast. But since it's New Year, since it's 2019, we are going to give New Year's resolutions to various people here. I'm going to start just to give Nick enough time to figure out what he's going to say, but also to sort of demonstrate the project and to build on the critique that Nick was having earlier. My New Year's resolution is to Mitt Romney, which is to say, go for it, bro. Do it. But not just to I think he had in his op-ed, like, I'll speak out against significant statements or actions that are divisive, racist, sexist. OK, we get that, Evan McMullen. But if you actually want to be useful in this role, that means that your enemy or your adversary is not necessarily Donald Trump. It is Mitch McConnell. It is. Go out there and hold your breath until you turn purple in order to get amendments on
like
the floor,
Thanos.
In order to get bills passed on the
Thanos.
Floor. Don't sit back and let Senate Majority Leader say, I am not going to allow X to be discussed unless I know the president totally loves it. X could be things like what Bob Corker tried to do earlier this past year, which is to say, hey, look, there should be congressional approval, up or down vote on if the president decides he's going to invoke national security in a very bogus way in order to slap a tariff. That never got voted on because McConnell was scared. And as Bob Corker memorably put it, we don't want to poke the bear. So let's poke the bear, Mitt Romney. And again, your adversary there is Mitch McConnell. If you want to get something done, instead of just say, oh, you know, it was a bad tweet and the tone is bad. Like, no, actually, what's bad is the way that Congress exercises its oversight capabilities and does its basic fucking job of legislating. And that is the memo. Nick, you've had enough time to figure out your New Year's resolution to a politician. Go ahead. Or anyone else.
I realized I thought you were going to end it with a Beretta-esque, and that's the name of that.
Team. God, see? No, look, you know, yeah. Don't steal your own thunder.
Go ahead,
Catherine.
I want to steal my resolution is to only steal Bob Seger's thunder in the future, Matt. Because that's all he seems to have. Now, my actual resolution, and I think I suggested this, I'm going to pull something out of the playbook of Mr. Michael Jackson, and I'm not going to resolve for somebody else to do better. I am simply like Voltaire's Candide. I'm going to try to tend my own garden better and not be such a dick all the time.
That was respectful. Oh, no, there was a snort.
I'm sorry.
Catherine?
I tried. My resolution for everyone in Washington, but especially for the Washington Press Corps, is to assume good faith. I think, you know, this is my resolution every day and always, but
what's your hidden agenda?
Yeah.
In proposing
thank
that.
Thank you, Peter. Just assume that the people who disagree with you because they think the thing they want to do is the right thing. And, you know, this is obviously not everyone acts in good faith all the time, but better to err on the side of assuming that people act in good faith, which right now we err way too far on the side as a punditocracy and probably as a society in assuming that people are acting in bad motivations. That's all.
Peter, besides utilizing the mute button, which works for all of what we just said, improving ourselves, having Mitt Romney be a jerk to Mitch McConnell and assuming good faith, the mute button is your friend. What is your New Year's resolution for other people?
Yeah, it's not far from that. I mean, speaking of Thanos, my resolution is for Donald Trump. And it also happens to be my resolution for myself, which is spend less time on Twitter.
Mm. I thought your resolution was going to be kill half of humanity, so that turned out better than I hoped.
Yeah, that was a real,
it was a bait
real
and switch right there.
They're just in a pocket universe. They're going to come back.
Yeah, that's actually
so are we, right?
Twitter. I think Twitter may have actually crossed into a I don't know what's the right term when something gets sour. I mean, it's like it's gotten pretty vinegary,
curdled,
lately, and I don't know if it come back. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Twitter is the pocket universe that we've all been sent to by Trump Thanos
and Elon Musk. That's all the pot huffing we have time to engage in here. Thank you for listening to the Reason Podcast. Special Wednesday edition of the Editor's Roundtable. Subscribe to Reason Podcasts everywhere, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Thank you, and sally forth.